Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, in the words of Simon Lambert, we should go on the spring statement, I guess. Yes, Simon, I guess we should. From what it all means for our money, for the wider economy, where the black holes have been filled, growth has been kick-started, as well as the future of cash ISAs, inheritance tax and stamp duty, as well as tax snooping. All that and plenty more. Don't forget, you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
Right, so this week, the Chancellor delivered her first spring statement against a backdrop of rather gloomy economic news. There would be no rabbits out of the hat, no flourishes of showwomanship that we've seen in the past. She promised only one major fiscal event each year, and that would be the budget in the autumn. So what did we end up getting? Gentlemen, welcome to you both. I want to start, unusually, with Michael Gove. I was actually listening to the Spectator's pod the other day, and he called it the Sabrina Carpenter spring statement. The content isn't very original. The essentials are just barely covered. And unfortunately, the Chancellor couldn't be straight about the costs, no matter how many questions we asked. So in continuing that theme, Simon, what pop star was the spring statement to you?
Well, Georgie, that's a question, isn't it? And I'm going to have to think of a smart answer right off the top of my head.
Well, that's why I sent it in advance, do you see, Simon?
Yeah, but I don't like to spoil the magic.
Well, that's true. That is true.
Justin Bieber, responsible for some big hits in the past, but looking slightly troubled and like he may not come back with any more.
Nice. Okay.
I can't believe you listened to the Michael Gove podcast, if I'm being honest, Georgie. I'm not giving you an answer.
Principle.
That smacks of a former MP trying to be down with the kids. Look, Sabrina Carpenter's a nice young lady, young pop star. She has no place being discussed in a spring statement fiscal event.
I can 100% see Michael Gove hitting a nightclub late at night and dancing to Taste.
I should never have gone down this route. I've only got myself to blame. Right, OK, who's going to take on the proper task of giving us what were the main headlines from the spring statement? And if I call it a budget, I'm sorry in advance, it just slips out. But at the spring statement.
Yes, so what Rachel Reeves needed to do was get the books balanced again. She has two fiscal rules. And she left herself £9.9 billion worth of headroom to meet them in the autumn budget. Things changed since the autumn budget. Things have a habit of changing. And Rachel Reeves's headroom had vanished. We were waiting for the OBR's verdict on how badly it had vanished. And what she discovered is that £9.9 billion had turned into her being £4.1 billion down. So she needed to find £14 billion to get herself back into the position that she was previously in. So this is in order that she meets her non-negotiable fiscal rule, which requires her to balance the current budget by 2029 to 2030, which means that we are either in balance in terms of day-to-day spending versus borrowing or in surplus. And miraculously, she came up with a package that delivered exactly £14 billion and took her back precisely to £9.9 billion of headroom, which, in the context of history, is not a great deal of headroom. The OBR helpfully published a chart in its report showing the headroom over time and the average, and Rachel Reeves is well below it. But to be fair, the latter-day Conservative chancellors were also well below it. And really what she's doing is she's continuing in a theme that's been set well before her. So, you know, we can't hold her entirely responsible for this. And I'll talk later about why I think this whole thing is a bit of a farce. But the key things in here were welfare crackdown. That was announced the week before, but it's been stepped up in order to get some more money in. Crackdown on day-to-day government spending, apart from protected departments. More money for defence, a bit of shuffling of the books there in order to make that work slightly in her favour as well. A growth forecast. Unfortunately, this was the bad news. That was cut for this year from 2% to 1%. That is a very, very big difference and actually means that over the entire forecast period to 2029-2030, growth will be about half a percentage point lower in total, despite the fact that Rachel Rees was delivered a get-out-of-jail-free card by the OBR, which decided that the planning reforms and rise in house building, which is not going to hit the 1.5 million that Labour said they're going to do over 5 years, the OBR says 1.3, even then, that is going to give an uplift of growth, which Rachel Rees flourished with great abandon in the House of Parliament about it being absolutely astonishing, of a solid 0.2% of GDP by the end of the period. But that's enough to lift growth in 26, 27, 28 and 29 based on previous forecasts. And if you add all of that stuff together and the other little bits in there, bish, bosh, bang, £9.9 billion of fiscal headroom returned. Apart from if you read the OBR note that says this is reliant on a number of assumptions that may not turn out to be correct, and also could be derailed by a certain Mr. Donald J. Trump in America who may potentially have already derailed it.
For those not fluent in economics, Lee, what does it actually mean for our money? Was there anything in this, and I'm not talking about the things that might happen, like cash ISAs, we'll get into that, I'm not talking about things that weren't mentioned, like stamp duty, we'll get into that. Anything that directly impacts our money. I mean, I heard there that we would all be £500 a year better off. Woo, that's great. I mean, more planning, more homes. Great. Is that quite as good as it sounds?
Yeah and no, because it's based on a lot of assumptions, as Simon just said. And I think the thing to point out here from the OBR when it comes to our own finances is inflation. We've obviously come off the back of some really nasty sky-high inflation that we probably don't want to go back to again. But the OBR has forecast it is uprated where it thinks inflation is going to go compared to the autumn budget. So 60 bips higher than what was forecast in October. So that would be an average of 3.2% over the course of the rest of this year. It's saying the reason for that is pointing to wholesale gas prices, which you can't really hold the government to account for. But what that possibly will mean is it's going to be harder for the Bank of England to hit the target of its target of 2%. And it could mean that interest rates are going to fall more slowly than what was projected previously. Now, what that means for our finances, of course, is that we're probably going to see, we've obviously discussed it a lot on the podcast in recent years, mortgage rates, for example. We're not going to be going back to anywhere near what we were previously paying on our mortgages. That's probably the big one from this OBR document. But fundamentally, this is a fiscal statement. It's not a sweeping budget where we have lots of announcements over taxes and that kind of thing. We've had that already, and a lot of that's already factored in and forecast. You know, this is meant to be the kind of slow and steady, boring fiscal event, not the rabbit out of the hat event. And we kind of got that. You know, we said in the run-up that there probably wasn't going to be much happening for our own tax take. We've digested all of that already, so that's kind of where we're at.
So what's been the fallout, Simon? I imagine politicians are of all stripes are rather frightened now of big fiscal events, given what happened in the mini budget. But what have markets made of this event? What have the experts been saying who've been poring over the details? What are Labour politicians themselves saying?
Firstly, I think it's worth noting that the context that any of these things are delivered in is unfortunate, because there's this how are the markets going to react scenario, and it ends up with us making policy based on, you know, how this mythical creature, the markets, is going to react, and we can't possibly potentially do the things we need to do because they might not like it, and we're scarred by the Liz Truss Kwasi Kwarteng episode. But the Liz Truss Kwasi Kwarteng episode was largely due to the fact that they hadn't even bothered to get the OBR to do a proper report on it and cost it, and it was delivered out of nowhere. And markets decided that in order to cover the short-term cost of Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng's moves, which, you know, they argued would bring long-term benefits, so actually wouldn't have a cost in the long term. But in the short term, what was going to happen is taxes were going to be cut, so we were going to have less money coming in, which would mean that the government would therefore need to borrow more money in order to fund, you know, Britain's day-to-day bills. And that if we were going to be borrowing such a large amount more money, then markets wanted a larger amount, a larger rate of interest in order to lend to us, which triggered a bit of a doom loop with the pension LDI stuff. And it came at the worst possible moment for it as well. So there's a lot of stuff to unpick there. What we're looking at the moment is markets that are much more sanguine, but that didn't really like Rachel Reeves's budget. So after Rachel Reeves's budget, we saw borrowing costs rise. Borrowing costs then came back down again a bit. But also you have to factor into that what also happened was the election of Donald Trump, and therefore a view that interest rates would have to stay higher in America and American borrowing costs would be higher. Therefore, there's a knock-on effect for us. We then had a little mini freak out in early January as well, where we saw gilt yields go up and they come down a bit. But to go back to the what happened this week, not a lot really. Basically, gilt yields went up a bit, came down a bit, went up a bit, but they have climbed to a three-month high now. 10-year bond yields spiked above 4.8% to reach their highest level since January the 15th. But the context behind that is not the spring statement. It is also the fact that Donald Trump announced a fresh front in his global trade war with his 25% tariff on overseas cars. You know, that is something that rocked the markets. So it's very difficult to take this, you know, individually. In terms of what the response has been politically, obviously the Labour Party like it, if you're a senior member of the Labour Party, and therefore you have to toe the line. If you are not a senior member of the Labour Party and do not have to toe the line, then you can sound very aggrieved about the cuts to welfare and particularly to disability payments, where there is a great concern that people who genuinely do need help are going to get caught up in the net of a crackdown on the extremely large amount of money we're spending on an extremely large amount of people who currently are claiming some form of sickness benefit, and that's unsustainable. But there is a great deal of concern about the collateral damage, and whenever anything like this happens, you can always find examples of people who are suddenly going to miss out and suddenly going to be hit, and policies that are going to be unfair. We then find ourselves in the strange scenario of where, like, for example, the Tories, who broadly speaking would normally support welfare crackdowns, are having a pop at Labour over the welfare crackdown. The national insurance hike for employers is still to come in. They're saying basically you've already crashed the economy. So there's, you know, there's this big political row going on over it. Broadly speaking, the reaction from markets has been, this is OK. This is just more of the same. But it certainly hasn't been a reaction that says, do you know what? This is actually going to right some of the wrongs of the budget, and growth is going to pick back up.
Lee, I think the big question we're all left with now is, will we get tax rises in the autumn?
Well, that's the rumour, isn't it, Georgia? There's been a lot of talk about that this week, that it will be necessary to make the numbers and the figures work. Trouble is, it's become such a hot topic, you know, in terms of how people are getting fiscally dragged into becoming higher taxpayers. For example, the NI hikes coming in for employers next week. All of these things, you put them in a pot, and people are starting to get fed up of feeling like they are getting potentially unfairly taxed. Is it all too much? And we'll talk later in the show about, you know, the talks around wealth tax. Obviously, that's not a Labour policy, but there's been lots of pressure being put on Labour to introduce something like that. Will we be hit further in the pocket as individuals in the next budget? I mean, you can't rule it out. You really cannot rule it out. And it all starts now, doesn't it, Georgie? We're half a year away from a budget, but we'll be talking about it for the next half a year, what tax rises could potentially come in and be announced in the next budget.
And this is what concerns me, I suppose, Lee, is because we saw what happened ahead of the last budget, and people made, you know, irreversible decisions, particularly around their pensions, over fears that there would be big changes to the pension system. And I worry that, you know, the next 6 months is going to, this void of what is going to happen and are we going to have tax rises, is going to be filled with all sorts of speculation where people will act on that speculation.
You'd like to think that some lessons might have been learnt from the last budget in terms of, you know, they had some leeway because, you know, it was the first budget, you know, under this new government. There was far too much kite flying. I mean, to the point where it was just absolutely insane. And as you say, people were making costly financial decisions based on speculation. In the end, a lot of that speculation didn't come about. But if this is all going to happen again, they need to, you know, the government needs to realise that for some things, they do need to be taken off the table, in my opinion, you know, to ensure that behaviours like that don't happen again.
Simon, does this statement leave more questions than answers?
It does, in the sense that, as you both just spoke about, we're still sitting here questioning our tax is going to go up in autumn. And that was the, you know, very much the initial reaction to this from all quarters, not just from those seeking to score political points, but also from, you know, the IFS, for example. There's also an underlying issue here, and not the one that you're going to ask me about in a minute, where, you know, I'm going to have a little diatribe about the whole exercise. But within the report, all of these figures are predicated upon, you know, our future growth, right? And within the report, the OBR makes an assumption about a very, very important thing in the economy, productivity. It presumes that productivity growth will be 1.25%. Now, that is lower than its previous medium-term productivity assumption of 2.2%. But even that has remained very, very ambitious, because if annual growth in output per hour, i.e. productivity, stays at its current rate of 0.3% over the next 5 years, the current budget, the first bit of that fiscal rule, ends up in deficit by about 1.4% of GDP, and that means that we miss the target by £48 billion. So this is actually the near £50 billion black hole in the heart of the spring statement. This presumption that productivity is going to go back up, despite the fact that productivity has shown no evidence in the past of improving in this country. And this is something that is a genuine issue for the economy. This, if you talk to economists, if you ask the Bank of England, if you ask Andrew Bailey about this, he will point to productivity being the biggest problem that we have and trying to get that productivity number up. And it's been described as Britain's productivity puzzle. We just don't understand what's going on there. Now, maybe it will go up. For example, perhaps AI will turn out to be an incredible boost to productivity because it makes the completion of tasks much quicker. Like, forget all the other stuff, right? It's the fact that basically something that would previously have taken you 15 minutes can now be done in 3 minutes, and that includes a minute for you checking it. Or maybe AI won't. Maybe AI will just turn out to be like the internet, a colossal faff that ends up with us being even less productive. I don't know. But there's all kinds of things that nobody really understands about why our productivity is so low. But it's very dangerous to make the assumption that it's going to suddenly rebound. Of course, it could just be that those productivity figures are incorrect or they're not measuring stuff properly. I was having a conversation about this with my colleague, Hugo Duncan, the other day, who has an excellent grasp of economics and business and everything. And he was saying, like, maybe it just doesn't capture the stuff. He's like, I mean, how could we not be more productive than we were 10, 20 years ago? When you look at the technological advances, you know, all of us in our jobs are more productive, you know, because the systems that we are using are much more productive. Is that being captured, for example? So maybe all the numbers just don't mean anything.
Which then nicely leads me on to Simon. I heard someone say, in the past, the OBR's role was to mark the homework. Now it seems like the uncle standing over you making you do the homework. It just feels like we're making decisions based on these numbers that are just a bit not real. And I know that it's called the dismal science, but I wonder if, because economics plays with math, that people actually mistake it for something that is unbelievably factually based. But it's not really, is it? It's just the best they can do with the information they have at the moment, but it's driving policy decision.
Yeah, and as the parent of a child who point blank refuses to do her homework, I would say don't blame the parent here. Potentially blame the child refusing to do their homework, right? And the parent,
the parent
is just making the best decisions that they can with the information that they have, hopefully for the future of the country or their child, in the sake of normal parents. But to go back to your point, I believe there is a fundamental issue here with the Spring Statement. I believe there's a fundamental issue here with the whole concept of what is going on. Ultimately, I think this whole thing is a farce. Not because of what Rachel Reeves said, but because of what is trying to be done here. Rachel Reeves has two fiscal rules. The stability rule, that the current budget should be on course to be in balance or surplus by 2029, 2030. This requires day-to-day spending to be met by revenues, aka tax, right? The investment rule. Net financial debt should fall as a share of the economy in 2029-30. This requires public sector net borrowing to be forecast to be lower in 2029-30 than the year before as a share of GDP. Noble aims, but let's face it, she made up those fiscal rules. They're not like hard and fast. This isn't like a part of economics that you just have to do. They're a variation on Jeremy Hunt's theme, which was the one previously. But we have had 9 changes to our fiscal rules in 16 years as chancellors endlessly tinker with them. And what we find ourselves doing is trying to meet what are pretty much arbitrary, no noble aims, but arbitrary rules with forecasts that will almost certainly turn out to be wrong. You may be able to forecast what is going to happen over the next year with reasonable accuracy, although I would seriously question whether you can actually do that, especially with the way things are at the moment. But, you know, let's accept that possibility. What you certainly cannot do is accurately forecast what is going to happen over the next 5 years. And yet, we were treated to the spectacle of the Chancellor standing up and announcing decisions that had been made in order to return herself to her amount of fiscal headroom using her arbitrary fiscal rules and projections from the OBR, which, as great as the OBR is, are not going to be right. Now, the clue to understanding why they're not going to be right is the fact that Rachel Reeves had to stand up and change a load of stuff from the budget, which was less than 5 months ago, because the budget left her £9.9 billion worth of fiscal of headroom based on the same rules, mm-hmm. but with different projections from the OBR, which less than 5 months later turned out to not be right at all. Part of the not being right is the arrival of Donald Trump as president. But who would have guessed he was going to be president at the end of October? It's a complete farce. And the problem is that we are making decisions for the long-term prosperity and future of this country at an absolutely vital point. You know, we could have used this year as the turning point for that productivity, for that growth, for the getting ourselves back on track and removing ourselves from a scenario where we have to keep hitting people with tax traps and fiscal drag and cuts at the time when, you know, our public services are absolutely creaking at the seams and falling apart. And instead, we're taking money out of those, we're continuing with the tax madness, all to just meet some fiscal rules based on some projections that aren't going to be right. And, you know, that headroom thing, the fact that Rachel Reeves returned herself back to £9.9 billion, I imagine that she thought the symbolism of this was nice. But to me, it just illustrates the total futility of the exercise. Like, returning yourself to that precise number, it just shows how you're just shuffling deck chairs, as far as I'm concerned. And also, £9.9 billion, this headroom, right? I mean, to put that in context, the UK's annual government spending is £1.23 trillion. That's 124 times the headroom. You should really avoid comparing household budgets to government budgets. You shouldn't do this. But to put it in context, this is the equivalent of someone earning £50,000 a year, giving themselves £403 of leeway. It's madness. You know, I'm not calling for what I described in my column this week as a Trussian revolution, where we totally rip up the idea of balancing the books. But we've got to stop this insanity that is frankly just damaging the country, because we're not making the right decisions and the decisions that we need to make based on you know, what we need to do. We're making them to tick boxes and get the right answers in a spreadsheet. And to be honest, I think that's a really bad way to do things.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Dan Beecroft of Charles Stanley Direct for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Dan, we've got a very quick and topical question here from a listener. Can I open a stocks and shares ISA and pay money in before the end of the tax year, but not invest it?
Yes, you can open a stocks and shares ISA, pay money into it before the end of the tax year, and you don't have to invest it straight away. This allows you to utilise your ISA allowance for the current tax year, which is £20,000. The funds will remain in the ISA as cash until you decide to invest them. And it's important to note that the deadline for contributing to your ISA is the 5th of April. While it's perfectly fine to leave money in cash within a stocks and shares ISA, it's generally not advisable to keep it there for the long term. Cash holdings typically offer lower returns compared to investments in stocks and shares, which historically show better growth potential over long periods. It's also not unheard of for people to contribute to a stocks and shares ISA, forget to invest it, and then leave it as cash for much longer than optimal, and that should be avoided. Equally, if you're opening a new ISA, it might take a little while for the account to be opened, so you should act pretty promptly to ensure that you get it before the tax year end. And then finally, obviously, utilising ISAs can be hugely effective and part of a general sort of financial planning approach, but if you do have any further questions or need any guidance, you can book a free 15-minute coaching call with Charles Stanley Direct, and we're here to help.
Thank you very much, Dan.
Thanks, Simon.
Welcome back. Buried in the spring statement document was confirmation after weeks of speculation that cash ISAs are under review. The Treasury said future reforms will aim to get the balance right between cash and equities to earn better returns for savers, boost the culture of retail investment, and support the growth mission. So, Lee Boyce, what does that mean?
Well, this is the classic thing that happens. Let's take you into what happens on an autumn budget or spring statement at the desk, what you're looking for when the documents are being published. There are some personal finance terms that I will control F, have a look, see what I can find in there. And one of the first things I always look at is individual savings accounts. What's changing? Anything going to be happening going on? And obviously, the last couple of months, there has been speculation that cash ISAs are under threat the way they currently exist at the moment. And in the document, as you just said, it's clear that this is now definitely on the cards. Now, what has been mooted, basically, is a smaller cash ISA allowance. So currently, there's a £20,000 ISA allowance that we have as individuals every tax year. The new tax year is coming up on the 6th of April. We can do what we want with it. We can put the whole thing in cash. We can put the whole things in stocks and shares ISA. We can split between the two of them. What the government has been kind of asked to do by some within the city is basically make cash ISAs less attractive to get more people investing, essentially. But by doing it, I would argue, by force like this, is probably not going to end the way that the Chancellor expects, especially going by the comment section on the story where this was published. You know, people use ISAs for different things. Now, if you're someone in your 20s, 30s, 40s, you know, putting it into stocks and shares ISA probably does make the most amount of sense in terms of investing for the long term, you know, getting better growth than what you're going to get from a cash ISA savings account. Now, cash ISAs in the last couple of years, the rates haven't been too bad. You could still get 5% on a cash ISA. Mm-hmm. And lots of people that are potentially retirement age, for example, who don't have the investment risk appetite, don't want to take the investment risk with their ISA. You know, it's their choice, you know, to do what they want with it. I should point out here that there is no change coming up for the 25-26 tax year. I think it would have been way too difficult to start tinkering with the red tape on what is, you know, Britain's probably best loved tax break. You know, there's hundreds and hundreds of billions of pounds sat in these accounts, quite equally split between cash ISAs and stocks and shares ISAs. There is a little bit more in cash ISAs, and people are way more likely to hold them and have smaller balances in their cash ISAs. We had the idea of the British ISA didn't we, in the last government that just didn't come to fruition. And it feels like this is kind of trying to do that, getting people investing more, you know, potentially to earn better returns and to get a better kind of culture of investing. You know, I would say that we do drag behind our American counterparts, you know, in that respect. But I would argue that tinkering with this allowance isn't the right way forward. The right way forward really is just more encouragement for people to take up investing, you know, more education on investing and gently nudging people towards investing rather than, you know, a sweeping reform change that I don't actually think would have that much of a difference. And I think all it will do for this new tax year, I think a lot of people have it in their minds to basically stuff their ISA limit in cash, thinking that this could get changed for the next tax year. That's what I think could happen. It seems to be very, very firmly on the cards, though.
Yes, well, quite. But, I mean, it does seem quite a lot, Simon, to put onto one measure. So let's reduce the ISA allowance. And therefore, lo and behold, everyone's going to go cash ISA allowance. Everyone's going to go and invest. I know also within the document, in that little paragraph, I suppose, it did say that they were working with the FCA, were they not, in trying to encourage people to invest. What would that look like?
It would look like the kind of education that Lee's talking about. It also looked like the NatWest share sale, but that got canned due to the election, and then the Labour Party binned the idea. But that was actually a Tory idea to try and get more people investing. They also had the British ISA, but that's also been canned. Yes, it's absolutely true that if they cut the cash ISA allowance, I would argue that it will make almost no difference whatsoever to the amount of money that's being invested. And on current evidence, even if it did make a difference to the amount of money that's being invested, it wouldn't go into UK stocks. It would go into US stocks because people are investing in S&P trackers and, you know, global funds. So, and also there's lots of people within, you know, the investing industry who say, look, this actually wouldn't make a difference. There are some people within the investment industry who have a huge vested interest in this, calling for more to be done to cut the cash ISA limit and force people to invest. But there's other people, for example, Carol Knight, who we had on from TISA the other week on the podcast, who said, actually, this is completely the wrong way to go about it. The education thing is key. It could look like a big advertising campaign. But I think what they need to do is they need to have a proper look at this and start picking off, you know, the things like the reasons why people don't invest. This is the stuff that we do all the time. It's the, okay, well, I don't want to gamble my money. And you explain, well, it's not gambling with your money. You are at risk. But in most cases, it's highly unlikely you will lose all of your money. You know, when stock markets fall, even when you see a big, you know, pandemic level stock market fall, that's a fall of 30 to 40%. And if you've invested and you've spread your risk, so all your eggs aren't in one basket, for example, you've bought a tracker fund, then it'll go down by that much. And then the market went back up. Now, there's no guarantee that that's going to happen in future, but all of the evidence that we have shows that. Or you use the figures, for example, from reports like the Barclays Equity Gilt Study, the Credit Suisse Yearbook, which show that, you know, investing is over time, you know, the best way to beat inflation and so on. And you explain all of that. Is that what we're going to get? I mean, that's what we need. But how do you do it? There's some, you know, nuance in how you do it. Probably not whacking people over the head with the cash ISA thing. We also might get eventually, potentially, the removal of stamp duty on shares. This has been a big thing that's been banged on about by the investment industry.
Explain that, Simon, how that works.
Well, when you buy shares, so stock market listed investments, you pay 0.5% tax, 0.5%. Now, that's a relatively small amount of money, but it's a drag on the amount of money that's being invested. But actually, if you remove that, you would probably have a scenario where, because people factor it in when they're making the investment, the extra 0.5% would go in to the stock market. It's one of those scenarios where instead of £100 going in at the moment, there's 0.5% tax on it, so only £99.50 is going in. But if you do that for every single £100 that goes into the stock market, it does actually make a meaningful difference. But there's other things that, you know, we need to do. And the real concern actually is about the health of the UK stock market, about the number of companies listing here, about the fact that companies are being taken out, they're getting bought out by overseas rivals or by private equity, and there's not new companies coming in their place. And that the new companies coming in, or particularly the companies that are growing and showing, you know, real potential on the stock market are eyeing up moving to America instead. Now, it might be that that is just the pendulum swinging too far and the pendulum swings back the other way. You know, potentially one of the outcomes of Donald Trump's presidency might be that people see it as less attractive to list in the US, more attractive to list in the UK, which, let's face it, for all of our problems and the stuff that we moan about to do with the spring statement, is still seen as a very stable country, you know, with a solid rule of law run by relatively sensible people.
Indeed. Just one thing, Simon, what do you think we can do to swing the pendulum the other way? Is there anything that, some wins? And also, why is it attractive or not attractive for someone to list on a stock market anywhere in the world, but in specific countries? What are they kind of looking for?
Well, the reason why companies list on the stock market is twofold. One is because it helps them bring in money in the form of equity, which that they can then use essentially to try and grow the business. So they can use that to then invest in growing the business. And also, two, because of a profile thing. It helps with their profile. It does come with requirements in terms of how you report and what you do, the regulations and so on, that are more onerous on that company. So you need the benefits to outweigh what are seen as the potential costs stroke negatives. And one of the problems in recent years has been that companies, you know, some very, very famous, world famous companies are staying private for longer, and that there has been a lot of private money, you know, flowing around that will invest into privately listed companies. So, for example, venture capital money, private equity money, also the increasing number of investment funds that are happy to invest into privately listed businesses, although they will usually have some form of limit on that. So there are companies who are seeing less of a need to list on the stock market. But again, some of that was the function of cheap money. Some of that was the function of super low interest rates. And we've seen the taps turned off on that one. So you might, again, you know, start to see it swing back the other way. I think, you know, what we need in terms of, we talked about financial education for individuals, but what you need in terms of financial education for companies is, you know, what's the benefit of being on the stock market? You know, what's the point? Why would you want to be on there? Make it an attractive place to be and attractive for them. And I mean, I was talking to someone the other day who said they were, you know, they've got a business and they were considering listing it on the market. And I was surprised because I thought, well, I wouldn't have thought the business was big enough, that the revenue was big enough, although I don't know what the revenue is. I was like, oh, maybe these guys are actually making more money than I thought. But I thought, well, you know, also, why would you bother with the hassle? And that's what you want people to not be thinking. You want people to be thinking, oh, wow, that's amazing. Of course you'd list on the stock market if you could.
Indeed. Right, Lee, I just want to rattle through because we're running out of time, lots to cover. Even though it was a very short statement, actually, and I vote for that in future, maximum 20 minutes, please. But NS&I revealed a bumper net financing target of £12 billion in the spring statement, meaning it's looking to rake in more of our money. So, of course, this follows a year of disappointment for savers in which NS&I has cut rates on things like premium bonds and income bonds. So could rates, Lee Boyce, get a welcome boost from this? What do you reckon?
No, it's the other way around. At first glance,
all right, great.
At first glance, it sounds good. So the previous net financing target was $9 billion at NS&I. What that essentially means is how much money it can rake in from savers over the course of the year without being a kind of burden on the taxpayer, and it's the targets that it sets to make sure that it's well balanced and positioned in the markets and not be a best buyer, but also not be all the way down the bottom of the table, so no one's putting money in. Now, this target has a £4 billion buffer either side, which is pretty big. And obviously £12 billion is quite a jump on £9 billion. So you think, okay, so it's looking to rake in more cash. But actually, if you look at its most recent quarterly results for the quarter to the 31st of December, it actually taken in £5.5 billion just in those 3 months. So you extrapolate that over the course of the year and it's running above the run rate for the top end of the range. We've already seen 4 cuts to premium bonds since they peaked. We've seen cuts to income bonds, direct saver, all to slow inflows. The thing is, it's kind of sometimes the victim of its own success because people want to buy more premium bonds, either for themselves or for family members such as children. So it's quite likely that we will see more cuts for things like premium bonds over the next 12 months.
All right, Lee, thank you very much. In some good news, I suppose, for the Treasury, less good news for us and our loved ones, inheritance tax is expected to bring in a whopping $2.4 billion, more than previously expected by 2030, according to the latest official projections. Goodness me, that is a sizeable amount extra. Why so high?
Because we've got a raid on inherited pensions that's due to come in from 2027, which may, in certain circumstances, leads to double taxation, where people are having their pensions inheritance taxed, and then the person inheriting the pension, when they withdraw money, is paying income tax on it. And the government hasn't cleared up whether it's not going to do that or whether it is going to do that. But that could lead to 60%+ rates on those pensions that are being pulled in. Also, frozen thresholds, frozen tax thresholds, which come into play with what I was just talking about, and higher property values. And all of this is basically going to force better off families to hand over more of their wealth when their loved ones die. Which comes on to the question of a wealth tax, which raised its head this week. We've got campaigners, including a certain Mr. Gary Stevenson, who made his name by writing a book about his trading experience and then becoming a tub-thumping economist for the people who want a change in the system, arguing that what we need to do is bring in a wealth tax in this country. However, many people have pointed out that while we may not have a specific wealth tax, we do have a number of wealth taxes, one of which is inheritance tax. And if you look at the numbers on it, it is pulling in more money. The other one is capital gains tax. Now, if you look at capital gains tax, we've slashed the tax-free allowance from £12,300 to just £3,000. And that wasn't the Labour Party that did that. You've got Jeremy Hunt to thank for that one. And Rachel Reeves then raised the rate. And then we've got other taxes that go on things that might be considered, you know, bought by the wealthy. For example, stamp duty, which we'll talk about in a moment, which is a wealth tax. So once you add all of those things together, you have a sort of a little batch of wealth taxes, but not a wealth tax. Now, the argument is maybe we could get rid of all of those if we brought in a wealth tax and we taxed people who have tens of millions of pounds, you know, a percentage of their wealth. Or maybe we'd just end up with both sets of things, because that's what normally happens. And maybe this wealth tax that's being talked about by the campaigners won't actually make as much money as they claim. Because the reason why we don't have a wealth tax is because wealth taxes in countries around the world that do have them never really work properly. Because, amazingly, the rich seem to have this way of moving their money around to avoid the wealth taxes. Who'd have thunk? Who'd have thunk that that would happen?
Simon, you did mention about stamp duty. Unfortunately for many home buyers, there was no mention of the fact it's going up on April the 1st. And so as many as 70,000 house buyers are expected to miss that deadline. Unfortunately, it is a rubbish tax, I think we can all say, and it's stopping people moving around. One thing I do want to touch on finally, Lee, if it's all right, is if there's one thing that's more annoying than paying tax, a lot of tax, it's that other people are getting away with not paying it. We hate unfairness and people are blatantly dodging the system. So HMRC is going to get a whack load more cash, basically, to clamp down on tax evasion, but also implementing new technology to crack down on tax avoidance. But also, a bit of bad news, if you are someone that needs to file a tax return and either you're struggling to get it done or you're just a regular late filer, you are likely to get hit with heftier fines. Firstly, just briefly, what's the difference between avoidance and evasion? And then tell us what the government's planning to do with tax.
Well, avoidance is legal. It just helps reduce your tax liabilities. It's just sort of clever financial planning. Evasion is illegal. But she's looking to crack down on both to close what she's calling the tax gap. So there's going to be a lot more, it seems like there's going to be a lot more snooping powers and technology behind HMRC and more staff members to try and balance the books and make sure that people are fairly paying their share of tax. That includes new technology, I believe, that's going to make it easier for the tax man to see if you have breached your personal savings allowance, for example. It's very messy. It's very difficult to keep on top of all of these taxes that are due outside of your payslip. So they are attempting to kind of crack down more on that and spend more money on it. In terms of late filing, you know, this is a common theme every single year. You know, there's lots of people that are late publishing their self-assessment. What can you do to try and make it so that people don't do that while they're upping the amount that people will be fined if they're late? So if the tax is unpaid after 30 days, taxpayers will face an additional 2%, meaning a total 4% charge by day 30. So that's up currently, that will be from the new tax year. There's all sorts of other doubling of rates in order and encourage taxpayers to pay on time. What their thought process is in that is that it will play more sharply in people's minds when the fines are bigger and people think, got to do this. And also it could potentially boost the coffers, because we know what it's like trying to change people's deadline behaviours. You know, people will still fall into this category of not filing on time and will end up being fined.
I think it's about 1 million people filed late. I mean, that's 1 in 12. That's a lot, isn't it?
I was going to say 1 million because I haven't got the stats in front of me, and I thought, actually, that sounds absolutely a mad amount. But now you've said 1 million, I've realised that is the correct amount, and it's a huge amount of people. It's hard to argue with a higher fine for something that you have a lot of time to be able to do. But also, it is fiendishly complex. People kick the can down the road. If I had to file one, I would definitely be in that category of just thinking, oh, I'll do it next week. That's a tomorrow problem, you know. But, you know, we're journalists, so we've got an excuse.
Lee, I have to do it every year. Ugh. All right, then. We do have a reader question of the week. So we have a winner of the coveted This Is Money mug, and it is Robert, who is an avid listener to our podcast and really enjoys all the content. Thank you. Thank you, Robert. There is a question here. My question is about contributing to other people's pensions, for example, family members. So Robert recently discovered that he could set up a SIP for my 16-year-old son, who is not earning any income. I was pleasantly surprised when the government also grossed up my contribution. So the £500 I put in went up to £625. I also believe that if he decided to contribute more himself to his own pension, for example, birthday gifts, then he would also benefit from this grossing up, even though he's not a taxpayer and earning no income. Please, can you clarify that this is the case? And also, what are the rules around contributing to other people's pensions more generally? Simon.
Okay, well, firstly, there's an unwritten rule I think that we need to talk about here, which is you really probably shouldn't force your under 16-year-old to contribute their birthday money into a pension. I'm joking. It's great that you've done this, Robert, and it's great that you're encouraging your son to invest into a pension. But I don't know how well trying to get him to put his birthday money to go in will go. But the rules for contributing into a pension are that you have something called your pension annual allowance. And that is £60,000 each tax year for most people. But that includes any contributions made by you and your employer, and also that basic rate tax relief that's added by the government. So you yourself can't actually pay in £60,000. And you can get pension tax relief on what you pay in up to the age of 75. After that, you don't get it. Much to the annoyance of my mother, who is 76 and still runs her own business. And still pays tax, obviously. But to get tax relief, your personal contributions also cannot be any higher than your earnings or £3,600 if this is greater. So in this instance, for example, Robert's son is very unlikely to have earnings of more than £3,600 a year. In fact, he confirmed that he's not earning any income, which means the most that can go in is £3,600, including that tax relief.
All right, thank you very much. Finally, Simon, your stat of the week.
Right, we talked about the spring statement, we talked about headroom, we talked about different chancellors, we have that OBR chart in front of us. Rachel Reeves left herself £9.9 billion worth of headroom. Which chancellor, from George Osborne onwards, do you think achieved peak headroom? And I'll give you the choices: Osborne, Hammond, Sunak, Hunt, Reeves.
No, Kwasi Kwarteng.
Nigel Lawson.
Kwasi Kwarteng, interestingly, to go back to my point much earlier in this podcast, doesn't manage to feature in the OBR report because Kwasi Kwarteng didn't bother to get the OBR to quantify his headroom or do a report, and also didn't even actually deliver either A, A, actual budget, or B, what would officially be known as a kind of spring stroke autumn statement. He just made some announcements. Anyway, the answer, actually, very interestingly, is George Osborne. George Osborne, despite, or maybe because of, being the king of austerity, managed at one point to deliver £80 billion of headroom. But that was a big spike. Previously, his max had been about 57 billion, followed by about 55 billion, and then he delivered 80. Jeremy Hunt was at sometimes lower than Rachel Reeves's headroom. Rishi Sunak was generally above that. Philip Hammond was, broadly speaking, above Rishi Sunak. But at, right at the end of George Osborne's tenure, his headroom really dropped, and he was knocking around below the 20 billion mark.
All right, then. That is it for this week. Thank you very much, Lee. Thank you very much, Simon. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. Ask us your question. It can be anything. It can be something really simple. Ask us a really simple question, something that you just have never quite understood how it works or why it is. And we will try to answer that. You can find us on Twitter, X, whatever, if you're still there and you haven't flounced off due to Elon Musk's increasingly deranged behaviour. Or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past and join in the debate and read comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.